This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Pandemic, The Extinction Files, Book 1. Written by A.G. Riddle. Performed by Eduardo Ballerini.
Prologue. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter had been searching the Arctic Ocean for 3 months, though none of the crew knew exactly what they were searching for. At their last port, the icebreaker had taken on a team of 30 scientists and a dozen crates filled with some very strange instruments. The crew was told nothing about their guests or the mysterious equipment. Day after day, ice broke and crumbled at the Healy's bow, and the men and women aboard carried on with their duties, operating in radio silence as instructed. The secrecy and monotony of the crew's daily routine inspired an endless flow of rumors. They speculated while they took their meals and in their off hours, while playing chess, cards, and video games. Their best guess was that they were searching for a submarine or sunken military ship, likely of American or perhaps Russian origin, or perhaps a cargo vessel carrying dangerous material. A few of the crew believed they were searching for nuclear warheads, fired decades ago during the Cold War but aborted over the Arctic Ocean. At 4 a.m. Anchorage time, the phone on the wall by the captain's bunk buzzed. The man grabbed it without turning the light on.
Miller!
Stop the ship, Captain.
We've found it.
The mission's chief scientist, Dr. Hans Emmerich, hung up without another word. After calling the bridge and ordering a full stop, Captain Walter Miller dressed quickly and made his way to the ship's main research bay. Like the rest of the crew, he was curious about what it was. But most of all, he wanted to know if what lay beneath them was a threat to the 117 men and women serving aboard his ship. Miller nodded at the guards by the hatch and ducked inside. A dozen scientists were arguing by a bank of screens. He marched toward them, squinting at the images that showed the rocky seafloor bathed in a green hue. In the middle of several of the images lay a dark, oblong object.
Captain!
Dr. Emmerich's voice was like a clothesline, stopping Miller in his tracks. I'm afraid we're exceptionally busy at the moment. Emmerich stepped in front of the Coast Guard officer and tried to corral him away from the screens, but Miller stood his ground.
I came to see if we can provide any assistance, Miller said.
We're quite capable, Captain. Please maintain your current position and radio silence. Miller motioned toward the screens.
So you've been looking for a sub?
Emmerich said nothing.
Is it American? Russian?
We believe it's a vessel of multinational sponsorship. Miller squinted, wondering what that meant.
Now, Captain, you really must excuse me. We have a lot of work to do. We'll be launching the submersible soon.
Miller nodded.
Understood. Good luck, Doctor.
When the captain was gone, Emmerich instructed two of the younger researchers to stand by the door.
Nobody else gets in.
At his computer terminal, Emmerich sent an encrypted email. Have located wreck believed to be RSV Beagle. Commencing search. Coordinates and initial imagery attached. 30 minutes later, Dr. Emmerich and three other scientists sat in the submersible, making their way to the ocean floor. On the other side of the world, the cargo ship Kentaro Maru was moving through the Indian Ocean just off the coast of Somalia. In a conference room adjacent to the ship's bridge, two men had been arguing all afternoon, their shouts causing the crew to wince periodically. A bridge officer knocked on the door and waited nervously. They ignored him and continued yelling at each other. He knocked again. Silence. He swallowed hard and pushed the door open. A tall man named Connor McLean stood behind the long conference table. His angry expression made his badly scarred face look even more hideous. He spoke quickly, with an Australian accent, his volume just below a yell.
For your sake, this better blow my mind, Lieutenant!
Sir, the Americans have found the Beagle.
How?
They're using a new seafloor mapping tech.
Are they in a plane, submarine, or ship?
A ship. The Healy. It's a U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker. They're launching a submersible, though.
Do they know what's on the Beagle yet?
We don't know. We don't think so.
Good. Sink the icebreaker.
The other man in the conference room spoke for the first time.
Don't do this, Connor.
We have no choice.
We do. This is an opportunity.
Opportunity for what?
To show the world what's aboard the Beagle. Connor turned to the young officer.
You have your orders, Lieutenant? Dismissed?
When the door closed, Connor spoke quietly to the other man in the conference room.
We're on the verge of the most important event in human history. We're not going to let the barbarian hordes vote on it.
Dr. Hans Emmerich held his breath when the submarine's outer hatch opened. Behind him, Dr. Peter Finch studied a laptop screen.
Clear. Seals good.
Radiation?
Emmerich asked.
Negligible.
Emmerich and the three scientists descended the ladder into the vessel. The LED lights from their suit helmets cast white beams through the dark tomb as they moved slowly through the cramped corridors, careful not to let anything catch on their suits. A tear could be deadly. When they reached the vessel's bridge, Emmerich aimed his helmet lamps at a bronze plaque on the wall.
Prometheus, Alpha One, are you receiving this?
A scientist on the Healy responded instantly.
Copy, Alpha One, receiving audio and video.
The plaque on the wall read, RSV Beagle, Hong Kong, 1 May 1965, Ordo Ab Gao. Emmerich exited the bridge and began searching for the captain's stateroom. If he was lucky, the logs would be stored there, and they would finally reveal where the Beagle had been and what the crew had discovered. If he was right, the vessel held evidence of a scientific revelation that would forever change the course of human history. Dr. Finch's voice crackled in Emmerich's earpiece.
Alpha One, Alpha Two, do you copy?
Copy, Alpha Two.
We've reached the lab level. Should we enter?
Affirmative, Alpha Two. Proceed with caution.
In the dark corridor, Emmerich waited.
Alpha One, we're seeing two exam rooms with metal tables, maybe 10 feet long. Rooms are sealed for biocontainment. The rest of the area is filled with long rows of storage bins, like large deposit boxes in a vault. Should we open one?
Negative, Alpha Two,
Emmerich said quickly.
Are they numbered?
Affirmative,
Finch said.
I'll have to find the inventory. Hold on. There's a metal disc on each bin.
A pause.
The disc covers a viewport like a peephole. There are bones in this one. Human? No. Wait. They can't be.
Another researcher spoke.
There's a mammal in this one. Feline. Species unknown. It must have been frozen alive. It's still in ice.
Emmerich heard the clicks of metal discs sliding back and forth like the shutter of a camera.
Alpha One, you should get down here. It's like Noah's Ark.
Emmerich began shuffling through the cramped corridor, still being careful not to let anything puncture his suit.
Prometheus, Alpha One, are you recording video from Alpha Two, Three, and Four?
When no response came, Emmerich stopped in his tracks.
Prometheus, this is Alpha One. Do you copy?
He called a second time, and a third. Then he heard a loud boom, and the floor beneath him shook.
Prometheus?
Day 1. 320 infected. 0 dead. Chapter 1. Dr. Alim Kibbit sat in his white-walled office, watching the sun rise over the rocky landscape of northeastern Kenya. The Mandera Referral Hospital was a run-down facility in one of the most impoverished corners of the world, and it had recently become his responsibility. Some in his shoes would consider that a burden. He considered it an honor. Beyond his closed door, screams pierced the silence. Footsteps pounded the hallway, and a nurse yelled,
"Doctor, come quick!"
There was no question which doctor they were calling for. Alim Kibbit was the only physician left. The others had departed after the terror attacks. Many of the nurses had followed. The government had denied requests for armed guards at the rural hospital. They'd also defaulted on an agreement to pay the health workers fairly and on time. That had sent another wave of workers fleeing the crumbling facility. The hospital operated with a skeleton staff now. The remaining members either had no place to go or were too dedicated to leave. Or in the case of Alim Kibbit, both. He donned his white coat and hurried down the hall toward the cries for help. Mandera was one of Kenya's poorest countries. Per capita income was $267 US,
less than 75 cents per day. The dusty, dirt road town lay at the crossroads of three nations, Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. People in Mandera lived off the land, often barely scraping by, and found joy where they could. It was a place of breathtaking beauty and unspeakable brutality. The world's deadliest diseases were endemic to the region, but they were far from the most dangerous elements in the area. Al-Shabaab, an Islamic terror group, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, attacked the villages and government facilities frequently. Their ruthlessness was staggering. Less than a year ago, Al-Shabaab militants stopped a bus outside Mandera and ordered all the Muslim passengers to get off. They refused, and instead crowded around the Christian passengers. Al-Shabaab dragged everyone from the bus, both Muslim and Christian, lined them up, and shot them. 37 people died that day. As Alim raced down the dingy hall, that was his first thought. Another Al-Shabaab attack. To his surprise, he found two young white men in the exam room, their dark brown hair long and shaggy, their thick beards dripping with sweat. One man stood by the door holding a video camera. The other lay on the exam table, rolling side to side, his eyes closed. The stench of diarrhea and vomit was overwhelming. Two nurses were leaning over the man, performing an intake exam. One drew a thermometer from the man's mouth and turned to Alim.
104, doctor.
The young man with the video camera let it fall to the side and caught Alim by the upper arm.
You've got to help him!
Alim pulled free and extended his arm to push the man into the corner, away from the exam table.
I will. Back away, please.
Alim's initial diagnosis was malaria. The disease was rampant in tropical and subtropical regions, especially impoverished areas like Mandera, which was only about 250 miles from the equator. Worldwide, over 200 million people were infected with malaria each year, and nearly 500,000 died from the disease. 90% of those deaths took place in Africa, where a child died of malaria every minute. Westerners visiting Kenya frequently came down with malaria as well. It was treatable, and that gave Alim some hope, as he snapped on a pair of blue gloves and began his exam. The patient was barely conscious. His head tossed from side to side as he mumbled. When Alim pulled the man's shirt up, his diagnosis changed immediately. A rash ran from his abdomen to his chest. Typhoid fit these symptoms better. It was also endemic to the region and was caused by bacteria, Salmonella typhi, that bred in open pools of water. Typhoid was manageable, curable. Fluoroquinolones, one of the few antibiotics they had on hand, would treat it. Alim's hope vanished when the man's eyelids parted. Yellow, jaundiced eyes stared up at him. Blood pooled at the corner of his left eye, then trickled down the man's face.
Get back,
Alim said, spreading his arms out, sweeping the nurses with him.
What's the matter with him?
The man's friend asked.
Clear the room,
Alim said. The nurses evacuated immediately, but the young man stood his ground.
I'm not leaving him. You must. I won't.
Alim studied the young man. There was something off here. The camera, his demeanor, showing up here of all places.
What's your name?
Lucas.
Turner.
Why are you here, Mr. Turner?
He's sick. No, why are you in Kenya? What are you doing here in Mandera?
Starting a business.
What?
City Forge. It's like crowdfunding for startup city governments,
Lucas said, sounding rehearsed.
Alim shook his head. What's he talking about?
You know what's wrong with him?
Lucas asked.
Perhaps you need to leave the room. No way. Listen to me. Your friend has a very dangerous disease. It is likely contagious. You are at great risk. What's he got? You have to have an idea,
Lucas insisted. Alim glanced around, confirming that the nurses had left the room.
Marburg,
he said quietly. When Lucas showed no reaction, he added, possibly Ebola. Color drained away from Lucas's sweaty face, making his dark, shaggy hair contrast even more with his pale skin. He looked at his friend on the table and trudged out of the room. Alim walked over to the exam table and said,
I'm going to call for help. I will do everything I can for you, sir.
He removed his gloves, tossed them in the waste bin, and drew out his smartphone. He took a photo of the rash, asked the man to open his eyes, and snapped another photo, then sent the images to the Kenyan Ministry of Health. At the door, he instructed the nurse waiting outside to keep anyone but him from entering the room. He returned a few moments later, wearing a protective gown, face mask, boot covers, and goggles. He also carried the only treatment he could provide his patient. On a narrow wooden table in the dingy room, he lined up three plastic buckets. Each bucket had a piece of brown tape with a single word written on it. Vomit, feces, urine. In the man's condition, Alim wasn't optimistic that he could segregate his exiting bodily fluids, but that was the standard protocol for Ebola and similar diseases, and Alim intended to follow it. Despite having few supplies and little staff, the African doctor was determined to provide the best care he possibly could. It was his duty. He handed the man a small paper cup filled with pills, antibiotics to treat any secondary infections, and a bottle labeled ORS, oral rehydration salts.
"Swallow these, please."
With a shaky hand, the man downed the pills and took a small sip from the bottle. He winced at the taste of the mixture.
"I know, it tastes bad, but you must. You must stay hydrated."
On average, Ebola killed half of those it infected. Even when the body's immune system defeated the disease itself, the diarrhea during its acute phase was often fatal due to dehydration.
"I will return soon," Alim said.
Outside the room, Alim carefully removed his PPE, personal protective equipment. He knew they didn't have enough PPE in the hospital to protect all the staff who would need to care for the man. They desperately needed more equipment and help. In the meantime, Alim would have to isolate the sick man and quarantine Lucas long enough to determine if he was infected too. The middle-aged physician was weighing his next move when the nurse called out once again. He raced to the hospital's triage room, where he found yet another Westerner, a tall white man leaning against the doorframe. He was older than the other two, but like the other sick man, he was pale, sweaty, and smelled of diarrhea and vomit.
"Is he with the others?"
Alim asked.
"I don't know,"
the nurse answered.
"They sent him from the airport."
"Sir, please lift your shirt up."
The tall man lifted his shirt up, revealing a wide rash. Alim took a photo to email to the Ministry of Health. To the triage nurse, he said,
"Escort him to exam two. Do not touch him. Keep your distance. Leave the room. No one enters."
He dialed the Kenya Ministry of Health's Emergency Operations Center. When the line connected, he said,
"I'm calling from Mandera Referral Hospital. We have a problem here."
Chapter 2. He had been beaten up. That was his first thought upon waking. His ribs radiated pain. His legs ached. He reached up and touched the tender knot on the left side of his head and quickly drew his hand away. He was sprawled out on a king-sized bed, which was still made up. The morning sun shone through sheer curtains, blinding him and sparking even more pain in his throbbing head. He shut his eyes and turned away. A few seconds later, he slowly opened his eyes again. The nightstand held a silver lamp and a small writing pad. The letterhead read, "Concord Hotel, Berlin." He tried to remember checking in, but he couldn't. And more, he didn't know what day it was, or why he was in Berlin, or his own name, for that matter. What happened to me? He rose and hobbled to the bathroom. His ribs ached with every step. He pulled the blue button-up shirt from his khaki pants. A bruise covered his left side. It was dark blue and black in the center, flowing to red at the edges. He examined himself in the mirror. His face was fit and trim, with high cheekbones. Thick blonde hair fell to his eyebrows, curling slightly at the ends. He had a faint tan, but from his complexion and smooth hands it was clear that he worked inside, in a white-collar profession. He searched for the knot in his head. It was large, but the blow hadn't broken the skin. He reached in his pockets and found only a thin piece of paper the size of a business card. He drew it out and examined it. A 20% off coupon from Quality Dry Cleaning for Less. On the back, he, or perhaps someone else, had scribbled three lines of text. The first, ZDUQKHU. The second, 737962361 8. And the third line was simply three diamonds inside parentheses. A code of some sort. His head hurt too much for codes. He lay the card on the vanity, exited the bathroom, and walked through the bedroom into the living area where he stopped cold. A man lay on the floor. His face was pale and ashy. He wasn't breathing. A single white page lay near the dead man, in front of the door to the suite. It was a bill for the stay, which apparently had begun a week before, and included several deliveries from room service, and nothing from the minibar. Most importantly, the guest name was printed at the top. Desmond Hughes. He knew at once that this was his name, but seeing it brought no flood of memories, only recognition. The man on the floor was tall and slender. His hair was gray, thinning, and closely cropped. He wore a dark suit, a white dress shirt, and no tie. A ring of bruises circled his muscular neck. Desmond knelt next to the body and began to reach into the man's pants pockets, then stopped, his instincts kicking in. He grabbed the small wastebasket under the desk, pulled out the plastic liner, and covered his hand, ensuring he didn't leave any fingerprints or DNA. The man's pocket held a wallet and a hard plastic employee ID card for Rapture Therapeutics. There was no job title listed on the ID card, just a name. Gunter Thorne. The picture matched the pale face laying sideways on the thin carpet. His German ID card and credit cards all showed the same name. Desmond slid the items back into the man's pocket and gently pulled the lapel of his suit back, revealing a black handgun in a holster. Desmond sat back on his haunches, which made his legs ache. He stood, trying to stretch them, and scanned the room. It was pristine. Cleaned recently, no doubt. He searched it, but it was utterly devoid of any clues. There was no luggage, nothing hanging in the closet. The small safe was open and empty. There weren't even any toiletries. He checked the bill again. No calls. What did it all mean? It was as if he had only come here to eat, or to hide. Did he live in Berlin? If not for Gunter Thorne's dead body in the living room, Desmond would have already called the front desk to find a reputable urgent care facility. He couldn't now, not without knowing more. And he had only one clue. He walked back to the bathroom and picked up the coupon with a sequence of letters and numbers on the back. As he stared at it, he realized something about the parentheses. In financial statements, they indicated a negative number, a loss, a deduction from a running balance. How did he know that? Was he in finance? He sat on the bed and took the pad from the side table. What was the key here? Deduction. A loss. Negative. There were three diamonds inside the parentheses. So, -3, -3. Yes. The bottom line had to be the key. The first two lines, the message. The name of the code popped into his mind. A simple substitution cipher. And more, it was a Caesar shift cipher, used famously by Julius Caesar for his secret correspondence. Desmond took each of the letters and subtracted 3. So Z became W and D became A. He did the same with the numbers. That yielded Warn Her, 404-639-0385. He placed dashes after the third and sixth numbers, producing 404-639-0385. Warn her. And a phone number. Warn her of what? Through the opening between the bedroom and living room, he eyed Gunter Thorne's dead body. Maybe Rapture Therapeutics, or whomever had sent Gunter to the hotel room, was after her as well. Or maybe it was all unrelated. Or maybe Desmond had set all of this up to trap Gunter here. She could be an accomplice of his somehow. Either way, she might have answers. Desmond picked up the phone and dialed. On the third ring, a woman answered, sounding groggy. Shaw? Hi, it's Desmond. Hughes. She sounded more alert when she spoke again. Hi. Hi. He had no clue where to begin.
Are you expecting my call? She sighed into the receiver. He heard her rustling, sitting up, perhaps. What is this, Desmond? Do we know each other? Her tone was sad now. This isn't funny, Des. Look, can you tell me who you are, where you work, please? A pause. Peyton Shaw. When he said nothing, she added, I work at the CDC now. I'm an epidemiologist. A knock at the suite's door rang out, three raps, firm, from the living room. Desmond waited, thinking. The clock on the table read 7:34 a.m. Too early for maid service. Hello? Peyton said. Three more knocks, louder this time, followed by a man's deep voice.
Polizei!
Listen to me, Peyton. I think you're in danger.
What?
What are you talking about? Three more knocks, insistent, loud enough to wake anyone in the neighboring room.
Polizei! Herr Hughes? Bitte öffnen? Sie die Tür?
I'll call you back. He hung up and sprinted to the door, ignoring the pain in his legs. Through the peephole, he saw two uniformed police officers, along with a man in a dark suit, likely hotel security. The hotel employee was moving a key card toward the door lock. Chapter 3. In Atlanta, Dr. Peyton Shaw sat up in bed with the cordless phone to her ear. Desmond? The line was dead. She hung up and waited, expecting Desmond to call back. It was 1:34 a.m., Saturday night, and she had been home alone, asleep for over 3 hours. She was wide awake now, though, and unnerved. She felt the urge to take a look around the two-bedroom condo and make sure there wasn't someone else inside. She had lived alone since moving to Atlanta in her 20s, and with a few exceptions, she'd always felt safe. She grabbed her cell phone, rose from the platform bed, and cautiously paced out of her bedroom. Every few seconds, her bare feet squeaked against the cold hardwood floors. The front door was shut and the deadbolt locked. The door to the second bedroom, which she used as a home office, was also closed, hiding it from the open concept living room and kitchen. She'd found that pictures of pandemics around the world were a real mood killer for company and gentlemen callers, so she always kept her office door shut. At the floor-to-ceiling windows in the living room, she peered down at Peachtree Street, which was mostly deserted at this hour. She felt a chill through the glass. It was colder than usual outside for late November. She waited, still hoping the home phone would ring. She had considered canceling the landline a dozen times, but a few people still had the number, and for reasons she couldn't fathom, the cable and internet bill actually came out cheaper with the home phone. She ran a hand through her shoulder-length brown hair. Her mother was half Chinese, half German, and they shared the same porcelain skin. She wasn't quite sure what she'd gotten from her father, who was English, and had died when she was 6. She plopped down on the gray fabric couch and tucked her freezing feet under her bottom, trying to warm them. On her cell phone, she did something she hadn't done in a long time, something she had sworn she would stop doing. She opened Google and searched for Desmond Hughes. Hearing Desmond's voice had rattled her. His last words, "You're in danger," still lingered in her mind. The first hit was the website for Icarus Capital, a venture capital firm. Desmond was listed first on the Our People page as the founder and managing partner. His smile was confident, maybe even bordering on arrogant. She clicked the Investments page and read the introduction. "It is said that there's no time like the present. At Icarus Capital, we disagree. We think there's no time like the future. That's what we invest in, the future. More specifically, we invest in people who are inventing the future. Here's a sampling of those people and their companies. If you're inventing the future, get in touch. We want to help." Peyton scanned the companies listed. Rapture Therapeutics, Phaethon Genetics, Rendition Games, Cedar Creek Entertainment, Rook Quantum Sciences, Extinction Parks, Labyrinth Reality, City Forge, and Charter Antarctica. She didn't recognize any of them. She clicked the next link in the web search results, which was a video of Desmond at a conference. An interviewer off camera asked a question. "Icarus has invested in a really eclectic mix of startups, everything from pharma, biotech, virtual reality,
grid computing, and even extreme vacationing in places like Antarctica. What's the thread that ties it all together? For the entrepreneurs out there in the audience, can you tell them what you're looking for in a startup? Sitting in a club chair on stage, Desmond held up the mic and spoke calmly, but with infectious enthusiasm. A slight grin curled at the edges of his mouth. His eyes were focused, unblinking. Well, as you say, it's hard to categorize exactly what kind of company Icarus is looking for. What I can tell you is that each of our investments is part of a larger, coordinated experiment. The interviewer raised his eyebrows. Interesting. What kind of experiment? It's a scientific experiment, one meant to answer a very important question, which is, why do we exist? The moderator feigned shock and turned to the crowd. Is that all? The audience laughed, and Desmond joined in. Desmond leaned forward in the club chair, glanced at the moderator, then focused on the camera. Okay, I think it's fair to say that many of you out there, in the audience and watching this video, would say the answer to that question is simple. We exist because the physical properties of this planet support the emergence of biological life, that we are biologically inevitable because of Earth's environment. That's true. But the real question is, why? Why does the universe support biological life? To what end? What is humanity's destiny? I believe there's an answer. Wow, you almost sound like a person of faith. I am. I have absolute faith. I believe there's a great process at work all around us, a larger picture of which we have only seen a very small sliver. And you think the technology Icarus is funding will deliver this ultimate truth? I'd bet my life on it. Peyton had just fallen asleep again when a noise from the bedside table woke her. She froze, listening, but it stopped suddenly. It came again, something brushing up against the table. A vibration. A glow emanated from beyond the lamp, throwing light up at the ceiling. She exhaled, grabbed her buzzing cell phone, and checked the time. 3:35 a.m. She didn't recognize the number, but she knew the country code. 41. Switzerland. She answered immediately.
Peyton, I'm sorry to wake you,
Dr. Jonas Becker said. The German epidemiologist led a rapid outbreak response team for the World Health Organization. Peyton held a similar job at the Centers for Disease Control. The two epidemiologists had worked together a dozen times in hot zones around the world, and over that time they'd developed a special bond. It's okay, she said. What's happened?
I just emailed you.
Hang on. Peyton's bare feet again slapped against the hardwood floor as she raced to the second bedroom. She sat at the cheap IKEA desk, woke her laptop, and activated her secure VPN software, opening a remote link to her terminal at the CDC. She studied the pictures in the email, taking in every detail.
I see it, she said. The Kenyan Ministry of Health sent us this a few hours ago. A doctor at a regional hospital in Mandera took the photos.
Peyton had never heard of Mandera. She opened Google Maps and studied the location, which was in the far northeast of Kenya, right at the borders with Somalia and Ethiopia. It was the worst possible place for an outbreak.
It's obviously some kind of hemorrhagic fever, Jonas said. Rift Valley is endemic to the region. So are Ebola and Marburg. After the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, everybody here is taking this very seriously. I've already had a call from the Director General's office.
Are these the only known cases?
At the moment.
What do we know about them? Peyton asked.
Not much. All three men claim to be Westerners visiting the country.
That got Peyton's attention.
The two younger males are Americans. They're recent college graduates from UNC Chapel Hill. They went to Kenya as part of a startup of some kind. The other man is from London. He works for a British company installing radar systems.
What kind of radar systems?
For air traffic control. He was working at the Mandera airport when he became ill.
They have an airport?
Not much of one. It was a dirt airstrip until a few months ago. The government has been upgrading it. Paved runway, better equipment. It opened last week.
Peyton massaged her temple. A functioning airport in a hot zone was a nightmare scenario.
were inquiring about the airport, traffic, who was at the opening ceremony, other foreigners who might have worked on the project. We've also contacted Public Health England, and they're already working on it. It's 8:40 in the morning there, so they'll be in touch with the British man's family and co-workers soon. When we know how long he's been in Kenya, we'll make a call on quarantining them.
Peyton scanned the email's text, noting the names of the two younger men.
We'll start tracing contacts for the Americans, see if we can build a timeline of where they've been, how long they've been in the country. What else can we do?
That's about it for now. The Kenyans haven't asked yet, but if things go the way they did in West Africa, it's safe to assume they're going to need a lot of help.
Help meant money and supplies. During the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, the CDC had deployed hundreds of people and supplied equipment including PPE, thousands of body bags, and countless field test kits.
I'll talk to Elliot, Peyton said. We'll loop in State and USAID.
Is there something else?
We've just had a security briefing here. Mandera County is a very dangerous place. There's a terrorist group in the region called Al-Shabaab. It's as brutal as ISIS, not fans of Americans. And when they hear you're in the region, it could get even more dangerous. We'll be in Nairobi late tonight, but I was thinking we would wait for your team. We can link up with a Kenyan military escort and head north together.
It'll probably be Saturday before we get there.
That's okay, we'll wait. There's a lot we can do in Nairobi.
Great. Thank you, Jonas.
Safe travels.
Peyton placed the phone on the desk, stood and studied the world map that covered the wall. Colored pushpins dotted every continent. Each pin corresponded to an outbreak, except for one. In eastern Uganda, along the border with Kenya, deep inside Mount Elgon National Park, hung a silver lapel pin. It featured a rod with a serpent wrapped around it, the traditional symbol of medicine known as the Rod of Asclepius, most frequently seen inside the six-pointed Star of Life on ambulances. The pin had belonged to Peyton's brother Andrew. It was Andrew that inspired her to pursue a career in epidemiology, and she always took his pin with her when she went into the field. It was all she had left of him. She took the silver keepsake off the map, placed it in her pocket, and pushed a red pin into the map where Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia met, marking it as an outbreak of a viral hemorrhagic fever. She always kept two duffel bags packed, a first world bag and a third world bag. She grabbed the third world bag and added the appropriate AC adapters for Kenya. As soon as things slowed down, she'd have to call her mother and sister to let them know she was deploying. Thanksgiving was in 4 days, and Peyton had a feeling she was going to miss it. She hated to admit it, but in a way, Peyton was relieved. Her sister Madison was Peyton's only remaining sibling. The death of their brother had brought them closer. But recently, every conversation with Madison had ended with her sister asking Peyton why she wasn't dating and insisting that her chance for a family was rapidly slipping away. At 38, Peyton had to concede the point. But she wasn't entirely sure she wanted a family. In fact, she wasn't at all sure what she wanted from her life outside of work. Her work had become her life, and she believed what she was doing was important. She liked getting the calls in the middle of the night. The mystery every outbreak brought, knowing her hard work saved lives, that every second mattered. And as of right now, the clock was ticking. On the street below, a man sitting in a car watched Peyton pull out of the underground parking deck. He spoke into the open comm line as he cranked the car. Subject is on the move. No visitors, no text messages. Only one phone call from a contact at the WHO.
Chapter 4
Desmond stared through the peephole, watching the hotel security guard bring the key card toward the door lock. Two uniformed Berlin police officers stood beside him, hands on their hips. Desmond flipped the privacy latch, preventing the door from opening.
"Just a minute, please,"
he said in English, trying his best to sound annoyed.
"I'm not dressed. Please hurry, Mr. Hughes,"
the security guard said. Desmond studied the dead man lying on the floor. His mind rifled through options. Option one, go out the window. He walked to the tall glass and examined it. It was at least 10 stories up. There was no fire escape or any other means to get to the ground in one non-splattered piece. Besides, it looked like the window didn't open. Option two, make a run for it. He gave that zero chance of success. He was in no shape to push past three men, much less beat them in a foot race. That left option three, hiding the body and seeing it through. But where? The living room was furnished with a desk and office chair, a couch, a side chair, and an entertainment center. A heating unit sat under the tall windows and floor-to-ceiling drapes. A wide opening with double pocket doors led to the bedroom, which held a king-size bed with two nightstands, another window with a heating unit under it, and a closet. The narrow bathroom opened only from the bedroom. Quickly, Desmond made his decision. Lifting the dead man sent pain through his body. His ribs radiated sharp spikes that overwhelmed him, nearly gagging him at one point. The man was tall, about Desmond's height at nearly 6 feet, but lean. It was likely only 150 pounds, but he felt more like 300. Rigor mortis had set in. Gunter Thorne had been dead for hours. As he dragged the body, Desmond wondered how he knew how long it took rigor mortis to set in. But what concerned him the most was that he had never really considered just opening the door, letting the police in, and explaining his situation. It was as if somewhere in the recesses of his mind, he knew he was someone who needed to avoid the police, that he had something to hide, that if all the facts came to light, it wouldn't be good for him. He needed his freedom right now. He needed to find out what had happened to him. He was sweaty and panting when they knocked again. He dried his face, raced to the door, and cracked it, peering out suspiciously. Yes? The security guard spoke. May we come in, Mr. Hughes? Saying no would arouse suspicion, and Desmond couldn't keep them out. Without a word, he swung the door wider. The three men strode in, their eyes scanning the room, hands near their waists. One of the officers wandered into the bedroom, nearing the closet in the bathroom. The doors to both were closed. What's this about? Desmond asked. Better call about a disturbance, the police officer in the living room said, without making eye contact. He glanced behind the couch, then over at the entertainment center. He seemed to be in charge. Through the opening to the bedroom, Desmond saw the other officer eyeing the closed closet doors. He reached out, opened them, then froze. His eyes moved from the floor to the ceiling. He turned to look at Desmond. No luggage? I sent it down already, he said quickly, trying to seem as if they were wasting his time. He needed to turn the tide, go on the offensive to get them out of the room. What sort of disturbance? Are you sure you have the right room? The officer in the living room seemed to have finished his search. He turned his attention to Desmond. Are you in town for business or pleasure, Mr. Hughes? Bit of both. What sort of work do you do? Technology, he said dismissively. Listen, am I in danger here? Should I call the American Embassy? He let his voice rise with each line, sounding more frantic. Can you at least tell me what's going on? The policeman pressed on. How long are you in town for, Mr. Hughes? A week. What does it matter? The police officer was unshaken. It wasn't working. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the other officer setting up just to the left of the bathroom door, one hand on his gun, the other reaching for the doorknob. Desmond changed tacks. He focused on the security guard and spoke rapidly. You know this is going in my online review. The guard's eyes grew wide. Yeah, it is, Desmond pressed on. I think an apt title would be Stay Here for Gestapo-Style Police Interrogation and Crappy Wi-Fi. The guard looked at the officer. Are you finished? Desmond heard the bathroom door creak open. A second later, the lights flipped on. The police officer looked back at his partner and the security guard. Standing his ground, his hand still on his sidearm, he shook his head quickly. Yes, we are done here, the other officer said. Very sorry to have disturbed you, Mr. Hughes. Please, enjoy your stay in Berlin. The three men gathered at the door. The security guard had just gripped the handle when a sound erupted in the room, skin sliding across glass. The squealing noise ceased, and all three men paused, then turned back to face Desmond. Behind him, gravity had taken over, pulling Gunther Thorne's dead body down toward the floor. Desmond had propped the dead man against the window in the corner and covered him with the drapes, but he was free now. His face rubbed across the glass a second more before his body hit the heating unit and tumbled to the floor with a thud. Desmond didn't hesitate. He lunged forward, covering the distance to the three men in less than a second. He swung his right hand with all the force he could muster. It collided with the rightmost police officer's face on the cheekbone below his left eye. The man's head flew back and hit the metal door casing. He was knocked out instantly. Desmond rolled and pressed his body into the security guard, who was standing between the two officers, keeping the man from extending his arms. The remaining police officer drew his gun and was raising it, but Desmond quickly completed a 180-degree spin and rammed his elbow into the officer's forehead. The man slammed back against the wooden door, then tumbled forward unconscious, his gun flying. Desmond leapt to it, picked it up, and pointed it at the security guard.
"Hands where I can see them! Step away from the door!"
The guard's hands trembled as he raised them.
"I don't want to hurt you, but if you yell out, I will. Do you understand?"
The man nodded.
"Why were they here?"
"It is, as they said, a call."
"Who called them?"
He shook his head.
"I do not know."
"Who?"
"As I said, it was an anonymous tip."
"Are there more downstairs?"
"I don't..."
"Don't lie to me,"
Desmond said, raising the weapon. The man closed his eyes.
"Two cars arrived. I don't know if they stayed or not."
"Turn around."
The man didn't move.
"Do it!"
Slowly, the security guard turned, his hands shaking violently now. Desmond drew the butt of the gun back and clocked the man on the head, sending him to the floor. He dragged the guard's body back from the door, then ejected the gun's magazine and verified that there was no bullet in the chamber and the safety was on. He pulled his shirt tail out and tucked the gun into his waistband, then collected the spare magazines from both police officers. He took the younger officer's police ID and the radio from the security guard. He tucked the clear earpiece in and listened to the chatter for a moment. It was sparse and in German, but he understood it for the most part. He had to decide. Stairs or elevator? Front door or back? Each route had pros and cons. Racing down the stairway would only raise the suspicion of anyone monitoring the security cameras, as would going out the back. So, elevator, front door. He collected all the cash the three men carried, 312 euros in total. He needed the money to get away, and as he was already on the hook for resisting arrest, assaulting a police officer, and possibly murder, he figured robbery wouldn't complicate his situation that much. In the hall, he marched casually to the elevator and punched the button. It opened after a few seconds, revealing a white-haired woman who didn't acknowledge him. There was no chatter on the security channel as he rode down. When the door opened to the lobby, Desmond stood aside, allowing the woman to exit first. On the radio, a voice in German asked,
"Gerhard, are you still in 1207?
Desmond fell in behind the woman.
"Gerhard, come in!"
By the revolving glass door, two uniformed police officers stood chatting and smiling. They were 20 feet away. When they saw Desmond, they fell silent and stared at him. Chapter 5. Peyton arrived at CDC headquarters shortly before 4 a.m. The campus, though typically associated with Atlanta, was actually located just outside the city limits to the northeast in the affluent Druid Hills community in unincorporated DeKalb County. The CDC's precursor organization had been founded in Atlanta for one simple reason: to combat malaria. At the time, in July of 1946, the disease was America's greatest public health concern, especially in the hot, humid southeast. Being centrally positioned in America's malaria hotbed had been a significant advantage. When Peyton first began working at the CDC, getting into the building had been as easy as swiping her card. Now the process was much more stringent and included an X-ray and pat-down. She knew security was important, but she was still anxious to get in and get started. Every second mattered. Once security checked her in, she made her way directly to the CDC's Emergency Operations Center, the organization's command center for outbreak responses. The EOC's main room looked like mission control for a NASA launch, with rows of connected desks filling the floor, all with flat-screen monitors. A wall-to-wall screen showed a map of the world and tallied statistics related to current operations. The EOC could seat 230 people for 8-hour shifts, and soon the center would be buzzing with activity. Even at this early hour, more than a dozen EOC staff members sat at their desks, fielding phone calls and typing away. Peyton said hello to the staffers she knew and asked if there were any updates. The EOC's large conference room was dark, but a sign on the door announced an all-hands meeting for the Mandera outbreak at 8 a.m. A color-coded marker on the wall indicated the CDC's current emergency response activation level. There were three possible levels. Red meant level 1, the highest, most critical level. Yellow was level 2, and green was for level 3. The marker on the wall was yellow, which meant that the EOC and CDC's Division of Emergency Operations would be calling in staff and offering significant support to the outbreak response. Peyton was glad to see that. At her office, she began prepping for the deployment. Her duffel bag contained the essentials for any outbreak investigation: clothes, toiletries, a satellite GPS, sunblock, gowns, gloves, goggles, a portable projector, and MREs, meals ready to eat. The MREs were particularly essential for outbreaks in the Third World. Often, the local food and water harbored the very pathogen they were fighting. Peyton put in rush orders for the other things the team would need in Mandera, including location-specific medications, mosquito netting, insect repellent, and sat sleeves. Sleeves that slid onto smartphones to give them satellite phone capability with data access. The sat phone sleeves would enable team members to keep their regular phone numbers and contacts, as well as access their email and other data. Being able to take a picture in the field and instantly upload it could well change the course of an outbreak response and save lives. Next, she began preparing packets for the team. She printed maps of Mandera and surrounding areas and made lists of contacts at the CDC's Kenya office, the U.S. Embassy, the EOC, WHO Kenya, and the Kenyan Ministry of Health and Public Sanitation. She pulled up a questionnaire she had used in the field during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and made a few modifications, adapting it to the region. She printed hundreds of copies. Some epidemiologists were pushing to go paperless in the field, but Peyton still preferred good old printed forms. They never crashed, their batteries never died, and roadside bandits were infinitely less interested in file folders than tablets. Paper worked. That left one major decision: personnel. Someone knocked softly on the open door to her office, and she turned to find her supervisor, Elliot Shapiro, leaning against the doorframe. "Hi," she said. "How do you always get here so fast?" "I sleep with one eye open," he smiled. "Right. What are you working on?" "Personnel." "Good. You see the pictures?" "Yeah. Looks bad." "Very. We really need to be there right now," Peyton said. "If it gets to Nairobi, we'll be in trouble." "I agree. I'll make some calls, see if I can get you there any sooner."
"Thanks."
"Call me if you need me," he said, stepping out of her office.
"Will do."
Peyton looked up a number on the CDC's intranet directory for a colleague she'd never met: Joseph Ruto. Ruto led the CDC's country operations in Kenya. They had 172 people in Kenya, a mix of U.S. assignees and Kenyans working for the agency. Most were concentrated at the CDC office in Nairobi, where they worked closely with the Kenyan Ministry of Health. Peyton took some time to read Ruto's internal status reports. She was about to call him when she had an idea, one that might well save one or both of the Americans' lives. A few quick searches told her it was possible. It might also prevent the pathogen from spreading to Nairobi. Elliot once again appeared in her doorway.
"Caught a break. Air Force is going to give you a ride to Nairobi."
"That's great," Peyton said.
"Won't be first-class accommodations. It's a troop and cargo transport, but it'll get you there. They'll pick you up at Dobbins Air Reserve Base at 1:30. It's in Marietta. Just take I-75, 85, stay on 75 at the split, and get off at exit 261. You can't miss it. Elliot always gave her directions, even in the age of smartphone navigation, and even to places he likely knew Peyton had visited before, such as Dobbins. She never stopped him. She just nodded and scribbled a note. She figured it was a generational thing, a product of not growing up with a cell phone glued to his hand or Google Maps a click away. It was one of Elliot's many idiosyncrasies that Peyton had come to tolerate and then to like. "Speaking of planes," she said, "I want to get your take on something. One of the Americans, Lucas Turner, was asymptomatic when he arrived at Mandera. Assuming he's been in close contact with the other man, and assuming this is a viral hemorrhagic fever, I think we should expect him to break with the disease."
"That's fair."
"I want to develop a plan of care for him now. If he breaks with the infection, we can't treat him in Mandera. Dani Beach Hospital and Kenyatta National in Nairobi are both candidates, but I don't favor either. We risk spreading the infection to the staff there in the region."
"You want to bring him back here?"
"I do."
Elliot bunched his eyebrows up.
"What are you thinking?"
"I want the air ambulance to accompany us to Nairobi, then fly to Mandera and be on standby. If Turner even has a high fever, I want to bring him back to Emory."
Emory University Hospital was next to the CDC on Clifton Road, close enough for CDC staff to walk there. Emory had a special isolation unit capable of dealing with patients infected with Ebola and other biosafety level 4 pathogens. It was one of only 4 such facilities in the U.S. It had been used with great success to treat Americans who had been infected with Ebola during the 2014 outbreak.
"I don't know, Peyton. Bringing a patient with an unidentified deadly infectious disease back to the U.S.? If word gets out, the press will scare the daylights out of everybody."
"It could also save his life. And we could bring back blood, saliva, and tissue samples from anyone else who's infected. We could test them here in our BSL-4. It keeps the samples and testing out of Nairobi, and it enables the Kenyans to keep the outbreak quiet, which I know they'll want to do. We get to potentially save a life and get a huge head start on figuring out what we're dealing with."
Elliot nodded and exhaled deeply.
"All right, but I'll have to get the director's approval. They'll have to deal with the fallout and the press if it goes wrong, but I'll give it my full support."
"Thanks."
"What about the other American?"
Elliot asked.
"That's a tougher case. He was already in critical condition when he arrived in Mandera, and I don't favor flying him back to the U.S. We're talking roughly 18 hours in the air, maybe more. He could die in transit. Beating the infection may be his only chance. I want to take some ZMAP with us." ZMAP was the only available treatment for Ebola. It had been successful in treating several physicians who contracted the disease in 2014, but had yet to undergo human clinical trials. Its effects were largely unknown. Elliot nodded.
"You want me to get the legal guardian's consent to treat?"
"Please. The patients may be in no shape to give informed consent."
"I'll work on contacting the guardians."
Elliot glanced at the papers strewn about her desk.
"You selected your team yet?"
"Just about," Peyton said. "You ready for the conference?"
"No amount of coffee could make me ready for that."
Chapter 6. As he walked across the marble-floored lobby, Desmond realized why the police officers were looking at him. Because he was looking at them. The natural human reaction was to look back at someone staring at you, and the instinct seemed more honed in those drawn to law enforcement. Such individuals had almost a sixth sense about predators and threats. Despite her stoic demeanor in the elevator, the white-haired woman was quite frail. She shuffled slowly across the lobby, breathing heavily. Desmond diverted his eyes from the police, stepped aside, and power walked past her. She was moving away from the revolving glass door toward a swinging door with a silver bar straight across it. The bellhop was scanning the board of keys, oblivious to his oncoming guest. Desmond swung the door open and stood in the cool November air, holding it for the lady, facing away, not eyeing her as she slowly approached.
"Vielen Dank,"
she whispered as she passed. He opened the door to a cab for her, then slid into the next one in line. The police were still inside, but the radio chatter on the security channel was feverish now. They would send someone to look for Gerhardt soon. When they did, they would find the 4 bodies, only 3 of which were alive. In German,
The driver asked for a destination, which told Desmond that the hotel was not the haunt of foreign tourists or business travelers, but rather of native Germans. It was yet another clue, another piece that might reveal who he was and why he was in Berlin. Desmond almost answered, "Bahnhof, train station," but stopped himself. When the fallen police officers and dead man were found, a citywide search would ensue. Security would be intensified at the train stations and airports, and possibly along the highways and rivers as well. He needed to think. He needed to know more about what was happening. The answers might still be in Berlin. In German, he told the man to just drive. The car didn't move. In the rearview mirror, the middle-aged man scrutinized his passenger. In English, he said, "I need a destination. Please, just drive. I've had a fight with my girlfriend, and I need to get out for a while. I want to see the city." Desmond exhaled when the driver punched the meter and pulled away from the hotel. Now the question became where to go. His first priority was clear, to get off the streets of Berlin. The police clearly didn't have his description when they were sent to the hotel. The officers in the lobby didn't recognize him. Apparently, it was just as the security guard had said, an anonymous tip about a disturbance in his hotel room. But who had called it in? Had they wanted to check on Gunther Thorn, the dead man? Or had his death been loud enough to alarm a nearby guest who called the police instead of hotel security? As he rode through the streets of Berlin, a memory came to Desmond, of walking in a warehouse, his footsteps echoing on the concrete floor. Metal rafters hung high above, and the aisle was lined with cubicles enclosed in milky white sheet plastic. He could hear the faint, rhythmic beeping of EKGs, and could just make out hospital beds inside the isolated cubes. Plastic bags filled with clear liquid hung beside the patients, who appeared to be of all races, genders, and ages. Why were they here in this makeshift hospital? Workers in containment suits shuffled in and out of the patient cubicles. Up ahead, a cart was stacked with black body bags. Two workers carried another bag out of a cubicle and tossed it on the heap. Desmond was wearing one of the suits, too. It was warm inside. He hated the sensation of being enclosed. He couldn't wait to rip it off. The memory shifted, and he was standing in an office with plate glass windows that looked down on the rows of plastic-wrapped cubicles. The room was crowded with people, their backs turned to him, all facing a large screen with a world map. Red dots marked major cities. Arced lines spread across the screen, connecting the dots, representing flights between the cities. A man with scars on his face and long blonde hair stood before them, speaking slowly. "Soon the world will change. Stay the course. The coming days will be the most difficult of your life. But when this is finished, the world will know the truth. We saved the entire